Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is time for the podcast. We have a packed podcast for you today. We go to Russia. We're going to talk about Alexei Navalny. But first, how was your week, John?
My week was pretty good, but the highlight of the week, actually, Mac,
okay,
was young fellas roaring and shouting at you at the Bernie Sanders.
Oh, the gig. Bernie Sanders, yes. So that was, yeah, I mean, it was...
Like, Bernie was brilliant.
Yeah,
like, he was really good. The whole night was really good.
Well, it's interesting you say so. As part of the Doki Book Festival, I interviewed Bernie Sanders, who I know and I've known for a long time because, for a variety of reasons, but one is I'm on the board of his think tank, the Sanders Institute, so... We go over to Vermont maybe once a year. And I really like him. I like him a lot. And
he's a straight talker, isn't he?
He's a real straight talker.
There's not a huge amount of crack out of him, but he's...
Well, yeah, that's true. It's he's an issues man. And we laughed about that, you know, afterwards. And he said to me, he said, David, I don't have time. I'm 83. I don't have time for fun, you know.
The clock is ticking. Yeah.
But it's interesting. You say young fellas, you know, there were 1,100 people in the hall.
Mm, it was fab.
And there were... two people heckling.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. And they heckled for about 4 or 5 minutes in an entire hour and a half.
Well, what I found really interesting about the heckles is that, you know, everybody in that room, those 1,100 people, more or less all agreed with it. So they were, I don't know who they were shouting why they were shouting at Bernie.
It's a sort of
Bernie
performative
such...
act heckling, you know.
Yeah.
And what it's done is it's based on disruption and really self-absorption, right? Whereas there was plenty of space to ask questions. I mean, the whole idea is we set it up, Bernie would talk, then I'd chat to him, interview him, and then we'd open it up to the floor, which is the kind of, the way you should do these things.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was plenty of opportunity to ask those questions.
Yeah.
You know, there is one, I mean, the interesting thing is obviously at the end, Bernie got a standing ovation and he was really, really, it was a wonderful, wonderful evening. In fact, John, we're going to have it on Patreon. We're going to make this available the entire evening for our Patreon fans. And if you're not on Patreon and you want to hear this, you can join up at patreon.com/David McWilliams. So we'll make the Bernie interview available on Patreon maybe this week or next week, depending on your schedule, John.
Exactly. No pressure, like.
Exactly. What is amazing is, like, you know, at his age, to have so much vim and vigor and energy.
He's great.
And like, he just got off the plane. He was jet lagged and he was out and chatting and the whole thing. And of course, I asked him about Biden and of course, I asked him about Trump and all that sort of stuff. I mean, he was very diplomatic about Biden, but I think, you know, you can read in between the lines, you know, they've got a massive, massive problem with their presidential candidate. They have a massive, massive problem. It's interesting, we're going to be talking a little bit about Tucker Carlson's interview with Putin. And you were saying to me just that Tucker Carlson, there's a suggestion he might be Trump's VP.
Well, yes, that is one of the rumors that Tucker would be, it could be earmarked for the as a VP, which would be awful. Awful. Like, he is Mr. White Power Man, you know.
But again, you know, it's very good for Trump to have somebody that media savvy as your right-hand man.
Yeah.
You know, and he's very media savvy. So we'll release the Bernie discussion. And towards the end of the discussion, we talked a lot about Ukraine and Russia and Putin. And it seemed very opposite, given that what we know now about Putin. But did you know, John, it is nearly 2 years since the invasion of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
This week, it'll mark the second anniversary into the third year of the war in Ukraine. And we are going to go to that part of the world. We're going to talk to Sasha Kamenovsky. You'll know Sasha and I have gone to Ukraine together on a number of occasions last year. And we're going to get the reaction, his reaction, to the murder of Alexei Navalny. Because it obviously was a murder. He didn't just wake up one morning and decide, I feel a little bit sick and die.
Another one in the long list of murders.
Well, it's
by the hand of Putin.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, John. Because, you know, obviously, years ago, I went to Russia and I've been involved in that part of the world for a long, long time. It's actually three decades long now. My interest in and my efforts to learn the Russian language and get into all this stuff. But I was thinking, you know, Navalny died in a gulag, and those gulags were set up by Stalin. Well, they were actually set up, the gulags were actually set up by the czars for internal enemies in the 19th century. And what the gulags were was a series of prisons in incredibly remote parts of Russia, typically in Siberia, often in the Arctic Circle. And the idea was that the prisoners would feel so isolated by being so far away. I only got that feeling once before in a prison. I've ever been in a place called Fremantle in Australia, John.
Never been to Australia, actually.
Well, you've never been to Australia. So Fremantle is in the middle of nowhere, literally in the middle of nowhere. And there was an extraordinary prison there where a lot of Irish revolutionaries were sent in the 19th century. And the idea was the prisons were so remote that you felt that nobody cared about you, that you were gone. And so the czars created these prisons, the Romanovs, in the 19th century, particularly in the late 19th century. In fact, Lenin himself ended up in one of them, and that seemed to actually have emboldened Lenin and changed his worldview dramatically when he was there. But Navalny was put there. But the interesting thing was, I was thinking of, and I don't always think of Solzhenitsyn, even though I was a parapluie last week, I don't always think of Solzhenitsyn. But if you actually looked at what interested me years and years ago in Russia was when I was in school, I read two books by Solzhenitsyn.
When you were in school?
When I was in sixth year in school.
Right.
So by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, right? And we're going through a very pretentious phase of the time. I probably, obviously at this stage.
Hasn't come out of it yet.
Yeah. Obviously this, I kind of fancied somebody, so Jesus. If I'm reading Solzhenitsyn, you never know what she'll. Anyway, the point was Alexander Solzhenitsyn won a Nobel Prize for literature, right? He was imprisoned by Stalin, then imprisoned by Khrushchev, then released by Khrushchev, right?
Yeah.
And Khrushchev had this thing called the Khrushchev thaw. And it was basically a thawing in relations with intellectuals. And his most famous book, it was called A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a day in the life of a prisoner in one of those gulags where Navalny died.
Right.
And I read that, and it's a really interesting book because it was released officially. So you can imagine what happened in Russia, in the Soviet Union. Stalin goes on this crazy campaign against intellectuals, writers, dissidents, everything. He also had a coup against doctors. He thought that doctors were trying to poison him, his doctors. So he decided to kill loads of doctors just because he didn't like doctors, right? So this is the madness of Stalin's head. And so many dissidents were jailed in this period. And then Khrushchev gets in the early 60s and he says, okay, no, we're going to open up. And one of the first emblems of the opening up was the publishing of this book by Solzhenitsyn, The Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, right? And it was part of a series of publications by Solzhenitsyn called The Gulag Archipelago. And this is what it's all about. And he was identifying these places where Navalny ended up dying, right? Which were custom-made killing machines by the Russians. But amazingly, Khrushchev didn't kill people. Brezhnev didn't kill people. They imprisoned people. They exiled people. They internally exiled them.
Yeah.
They banished people. They gave them exit visas. But they didn't kill their opposition leaders. You know, Andropov didn't kill them. Chernenko didn't kill them.
Yeah.
Gorbachev. Putin kills his opposition. He kills people. So the regime has gone from a regime that kind of cheats its opposition in elections, like it rigs elections, to a regime that just kills people. And it's extraordinary to think about that.
But the BBC World Service also, the Russian service, also used to do audiobooks of Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah.
But it was always jammed. That was the thing.
It was always jammed by the Russians?
By the Russians. And we did, when we were, because I spent, 5 years at the Russians in World Service. But there was loads of, and especially the old guys, and I can't think of the guy's name who grew up in, his parents were
exiled into
the Gulag, and he grew up and then escaped from the Gulags and ended up in World Service.
They are, I mean, the whole thing is that, you know, there is a direct line, almost a do not pass, go, do not collect $100 if you are a dissident to the Gulags. And that's where Navalny died over the weekend. Now, if you're interested in Navalny, I advise you to have a look at this Putin's Palace, Navalny's documentary. There's also the Navalny documentary, which is a documentary about the attempted assassination, the poisoning of Navalny, which was scripted on the podcast. Do you remember Christo Grozev?
Yes, I do. That was a really good episode.
He was the editor of Bellingcamp. So if you go back, I think it's from last March, have a look at that. If you're listening to this, have a listen to this, because he was actually in the frontline seat. He was the guy who actually helped Navalny trace the very incompetent poisoners.
Yeah.
And the really interesting thing is they established Navalny was poisoned by Novichok put in his underpants, John. Right? So Navalny, one of his great slags of Putin was, he said, like, we had Catherine the Great, we had Alexander the Great, we had Ivan the Terrible, and now we have Vladimir the underpants poisoner. That's what he used to call. He used to call, you know, and you imagine Putin, this little obsessive man, angry man.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know what you've become? You've become an underpants poisoner. But the problem is the underpants poisoner got him this weekend.
Yeah.
So let's go. Let's talk to Sasha Kabanovsky. Let's talk about the impact of Navalny's death, what it means, what it says about Russia, and what it says about where Russia is going. So let's go and talk to Sasha, who is now again exiled in Berlin and can't go home. Sasha, how are you?
All right. Thanks, David. How are you?
I'm good. Okay.
I wish this conversation was taking place under better circumstances, but what it is.
Exactly. So tell me, Navalny's murder, his elimination, whatever you want to call it, what does it tell us about Putin, about the regime, about where Russia has gone? Since I first visited Russia many, many years ago, it just seems the trajectory has been progressively and now maybe acceleratingly in an awful way, in an awful direction.
Well, there's no doubt about that. You and I have had ties to Russia for over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And we've had a firsthand view of just how much the situation in Russia has deteriorated. And in essence, what we have now is the reversion to the regime of terror of the 1930s under Stalin. And the ease with which people get arrested and thrown into jail for 7, 10, 15 years for trivial, you can't even call them crimes, right? Accusations, innuendos, insinuations. People get thrown into jail for wearing jewelry. So there's a story of a girl. She was wearing earrings, frog earrings with multicolored rainbow-colored frogs. She was accused of supporting LGBT propaganda, arrested, and I think she's either awaiting sentencing or has already been sentenced. And so what we have in Russia now is this all-pervasive fear, where people can be swept up into this machine of repression for very obscure reasons, or no reasons. And I forwarded a video to you this morning of how the protester, I mean, that I don't even think you can call them protesters, just people who were gathering outside to memorialize Navalny, and the brutality with which they've been suppressed, dragged into police cars, and their future is quite murky at this point in time.
So let's talk about Navalny. Let's talk about the circumstances. The medical report has come out said he died of an aneurysm, which they have used again and again and again. And then his own doctor said he had no underlying medical conditions that would suggest he was in danger of an aneurysm. He was a reasonably young man, although having been in solitary confinement the last 4 years, any photos of him are gaunt or any evidence. But we're assuming that he was killed in prison. Explain the significance of the death of Navalny to Russians, and certainly of this coming generation.
Well, the circumstances of his death obviously are not clear. Perhaps they will never be clear. There are reports coming out that actually he did not die yesterday. He died the day before yesterday. interviews, anonymous interviews that Novaya Gazeta has been able to undertake with some of the prisoners in that colony, said something strange started going on the night before. There were lockdowns. There were unscheduled cars coming in, coming out. So the circumstances around his death are going to be mired in mystery for a long time. It's very difficult to believe that this was a health condition. After all, he was in Germany. He underwent treatment and extensive medical examination. So if they didn't discover an aneurysm or anything close to resembling an aneurysm 3 years ago, it's very difficult to believe that something happened of that nature. Over the last 3 years, he basically was tortured. He was kept in solitary confinement for 365 days, which is, well, I mean, that doesn't need any commentary. He wasn't allowed to sleep. Bright lights were kept on 24/7. He was malnourished. He did not receive any sort of medical treatment. But it's very difficult to say that there was anything in his current health condition that would preclude his untimely death. And so it's a premeditated act of violence. And the question is, why did it happen now? Putin had him in his grasp for the last 3 years.
So you have a situation where he gets transferred to basically an Arctic gulag in December, kind of suggesting that Putin is still worried about his popularity, the fact that he still had a sense of humor when he was being interviewed, the fact that he's still around, the fact that, again, you know, what men with small egos hate is mockery. And what Navalny always did to Putin was just kind of mocked him. He mocked him and he kind of said to the people, look, you have a bad health system because they have super yachts. You know, you have a transport system that doesn't work because they have private villas. Like, it was all this sort of constant mockery and taking the mickey. And again, this is the sort of thing that really undermines a dictator. But what happened in the last 2 or 3 months or even the last month to shift that, to accelerate that, to make that relationship deteriorate even more?
Relationship is an interesting word.
No, but I mean the relationship because it's very clear that there are two men involved here. There was Navalny representing one type of Russian and Putin representing another.
Well, I think that there are many opinions about what has transpired recently. My thinking is that there are several things that are happening concurrently. One, I believe that the war is taking its toll, not just on the Ukrainian population, but on the Russian population. And I don't think that this is being covered in the Western press. On January, if I may just digress for one second.
Do.
On January 28th, a news blurb came out. It wasn't covered in the West at all. And it was an engineer at a company called Almazantey. They build missiles. This is one of the largest defense industries in Russia. The engineer's name was Anton Gorobets. He committed suicide. And he left a suicide note in which he said that a rocket, a missile that he helped create, landed in a building in Kherson, in which his grandmother lived. And his grandmother died with the rocket that he built. And he basically couldn't live with himself, and he couldn't live with what is happening in the war and in Russia currently. And that sentiment, the Russian Putin's government is trying to stifle that sentiment and trying to show a unified front in the support for the war. But this war is filled with real human tragedies that span the borders. I mean, it's in essence a civil war because you've been there, you know how close the ties are between the Ukrainians, the Russians. Half of the population has relatives living across the borders, and it cannot not have an impact. That's point number one. Point number two is Putin is up for the sham re-election in March.
The coronation 15th, sort of thing, yeah.
Right? They trumped out a whole bunch of quote-unquote candidates, each one of them more nervous than the last when he was asked about whether or not he actually has a desire to win. But there was one candidate, Boris Nadezhdin, who was a former Duma deputy. He was an ally of Nemtsov.
Who was also killed by Putin, yeah.
Yes. And he has been an opposition sort of liberal politician who basically was brought out on all of these national television propaganda shows as the token sort of liberal voice to be bashed over and over and over again. Anyway, either by design or by oversight, he was allowed to petition to run for the presidency of the Russian Federation. He had a clear anti-war, anti-Putin agenda. In, I think, a month or just over a month, he was able to get 200,000 signatures of support for his candidacy. People across Russia were lining up to sign the petition. And I believe this caught the Kremlin completely off guard. There are no lines to sign up in support for Putin unless people are paid or forcefully engaged. And I think that was a wake-up call, that the position that they would like to believe that Putin enjoys within Russia is actually quite less stable and firm. And I also think that this interview with Tucker Carlson played a role. It's sort of a trifecta of things that have gone not according to plan, because I don't think that the reaction in the West to this interview was quite what the Kremlin expected. It was mocked. He spoke for 30 minutes, you know, about Russian history that never actually existed, something rewritten, tried to give Tucker Carlson some letters that Bogdan Khmelnytsky purportedly wrote. It was not a tour de force that he expected. And I think that all of this culminated in this knee-jerk reaction to finally put an end and send a strong signal to whatever opposition sentiment may still be in Russia, that it's an end game for
them. So it's an end game for you. So it's a bit like saying, you know, if Navalny is the guy who said, look, I'm going to show you what courage is. I'm going to come back from Berlin. I'm going to come back from Germany. I'm going to face Putin in his own jurisdiction. What Putin has done the last couple of days is basically show people that courage, although it might be laudable, is actually useless.
Well, it's the one card that he had to play. He wanted to play this card, you know, 3 years back, 4 years back. It actually blew up in his face, created a huge PR problem, especially with Navalny running this documentary basically into his own death, right? Getting the FSB officers who were involved in the operation to admit that actually, yes, it was the Kremlin's desire to kill him. And there's a huge axe to grind. And I think that at the end of the day, the regime is feeling vulnerable. My opinion, this is probably out of left field, but I think that there is a lot of vulnerability that is now being sensed by the Kremlin.
But if you just go back to your family in Moscow, I mean, what are they saying? What are they thinking now? Has everybody just simply, we mentioned Stalin at the top, right? Khrushchev didn't do this. Brezhnev didn't do this. Obviously, Andropov didn't do this. Chernenko didn't do this. Gorbachev didn't do this. Yeltsin didn't do this. I mean, you know, this is the behavior of somebody who is so far beyond even the last five or six end presidents of the Soviet system. I'm including Yeltsin in that, right? You know, you look at even the Brezhnev years. Yes, you read your Solzhenitsyn from Khrushchev, people were locked up, there were gulags, but they weren't going around murdering their opposition figures. I mean, this is like if the white South African government had murdered Mandela, had actually gone in and killed him in Robben Island. And even the white South African government didn't do this. So it kind of gives you a sense of how beyond the pale this sort of behavior is.
Well, I mean, you have to understand that no one talks about this. And the war and everything that's happening has torn families apart. And so the only way that psychologically people can survive who stayed in Russia is to completely withdraw into what is called in Russia internal immigration. And so this is not discussed. Politics is off the table. People have different views and depending on where they live. And so this is not something that is discussed amongst families and family members and friends. I mean, you know, a lot of things have changed for people who remained, for people who left. And it's reminiscent of the immigration out of Russia in the 1970s, because when people immigrated in the 1970s, before they left, we had funerals for them, because you're leaving never to see each other again, in essence. And unfortunately, this is back on the table, because in essence, this has torn families apart and no one expects to see each other ever again, until something radically changes within Russia. Whether that change is afoot is very difficult to predict. You know me, I've been optimistic or overly optimistic on this, but everything about Russia internally is showing signs of significant fissures. And how long they can sustain this internal pressure cooker before it blows is anyone's guess.
Can I just ask you about, you mentioned the Tucker Carlson interview. Again, it was seen, I think, 60 or 70 million times. I mean, this is a huge moment. Now, let's just talk about United States, right? Over the last 5 or 6 months, a significant part of the Republican Party has been leading a charge against Ukraine, against financing Ukraine, you had Trump out last Thursday saying to Lithuanians, Latvians, Poles, Ukrainians, look, you guys, and saying to Germans, you guys don't want to pay for NATO? Well, we're not going to defend you. I mean, basically giving Putin the greenest of green lights to do whatever the hell he likes, right? Explain to me with your other cap on, which is somebody who immigrated to the States a long time ago, and obviously you're back down. How do you think this will play out amongst Republicans who are really holding the Ukrainians to ransom and don't seem to be joining up the dots at all?
Well, obviously, it's heartbreaking to see what is happening in U.S. politics, especially with regard to this issue. We have to take into consideration that everything is tied into what's going on at the border and the huge influx of immigrants and the power politics that are being played. And unfortunately, Ukraine is being held in the balance to try to get some sort of a resolution to what is considered in the U.S. a much bigger problem than obviously a war that's thousands of miles away. When I have a hard time explaining or getting to terms with U.S. foreign policy, I always sort of turn back to Churchill, who said that you can count on America to do the right thing after it tries everything else.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping that this is yet one more case of that situation playing out. I have a hard time believing that even the most hardened conservatives in the U.S. cannot appreciate the existential threat to not just European security, but global security that this situation presents, especially with the new intel that's coming out about Russia trying to place nuclear weapons in space. I mean, this is a regime that's playing basically, right? I mean, it's playing like a zero-sum game, fighting for its survival. And it's grasping at every straw that it can possibly have in order to cow whatever, the West, the East, into acquiescence. And that's a road, I mean, once again, personal opinion, but that's a road that doesn't lead to a good place. It never does. And this problem, it may go away on its own. I truly believe that the internal situation within Russia is deteriorating much more rapidly than the West would like you to believe, or at least some elements in the West would like you to believe. I don't think that they have the capability to run a war for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. The toll, the human toll, the economic toll, the moral toll is far too great. It's incredibly difficult to sustain. Just the madness that is happening in Russian schools and Russian kindergartens, across Russian society, the oppression, the madness. Anyone can just go on YouTube and see video clips of what is happening in kindergartens.
What is happening?
Every school and every kindergarten now has a hero's desk where basically, I can't even call them soldiers, but these mercenaries who were killed in the war with Ukraine are deified. Children are made to wear military uniforms. They march around with machine guns. All of the regalia from the Soviet Union has come back so that you see the pioneers' uniforms and this hyper-patriotism. Veterans come to schools speaking to 6-, 7-, 8-year-olds saying that it's not scary to die. It's really not. The death is not something to be feared as long as you're sacrificing your life for the motherland. There's this pervasive death cult that's being ingrained in these children. To prepare them, I mean, it's almost like a jihadist cult that is being perpetuated across the country.
But this sounds like a regime that's in for the long haul. This sounds like a regime that said, okay, we're going to get rid of the internal opposition. We're going to beat the Ukrainians. We're going to get this back. And then we're going to say, look, the West are a bunch of divided, uncommitted, The original Putin idea was, listen, the West are old and fat and middle class. They've no real stomach. And now, you know what? Trump gets in. It's a very, very, very short game till next November. And he could be away scot-free.
I agree that the game that they're trying to play is for the long term. But every long term game needs to have a solid foundation. Right. And it's much easier. I mean, without being overly cynical about this, right? The difficulties that the West is facing are, I mean, you know, we have our own issues, but they're societal issues. Fundamentally, if you're looking at economics, if you're looking about that sort of the overall health of the economies throughout, we're not fighting wars on our own territory. People are not getting killed by the hundreds of thousands on a daily basis. We have a much better foundation to play the long game at the expense of Ukraine, unfortunately. And this is the heartbreaking part, because if we actually did, and you remember this from our trips to Kyiv, people do not want to surrender. They will not give up, and they just want to have the resources that are necessary to carry on the fight. It's much more difficult to sustain this long term. Yes, the regime is in for the long term, but the horse that they're riding is not a championship caliber steep. It's an economy that is a 19th century economy. They're completely reliant on China for technology, for everything. I mean, basically, the Russian economy has been China-fied. Everything in Russia now comes from China. Cars are from China. Technology is from China. I mean, it's basically China is the de facto supplier of Russia, except for Iran and North Korea that are supplying the weapons. But does that make a mix for an ability to sustain, you know, a war over 2-3 years? I don't know. I have no idea. What I do know is that people are scared. There's a prevailing, a horrible sense of fear. And whether or not, you know, there's anything left in the gas tank to try to throw off the shackles of this authoritarian regime, I don't know. The regions are certainly much more rested. And you've seen that in Buryatia, you've seen that in the Caucasus, where people are not as willing to comply with what's happening.
John, you want to come in there?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting, Sasha, that only last week the Russian ambassador to the UK was talking about Russia has endless resources and therefore will win the war. I'm assuming that's just part of the narrative that they're spinning. But the question I want to ask you is that you mentioned vulnerability a little earlier, and I was just wondering who is in place that can take advantage of that vulnerability. In other words, like who's the next Navalny, or is there one?
The cupboard, quite frankly, I mean, the cupboard is bare, right? So I'm not here to offer false hope. But why I think that the Nadezhdin example is important, and what that says is that, you know, there may not be an obvious leader of the opposition movement today, someone who is charismatic and who can bear the torch from Navalny. But desperate times call for desperate measures, and perhaps the people themselves can rally around someone who is willing to stand up and, you know, maybe people who we are not aware of right now. But the support from Nadezhdin was real, and I think that this was something that truly scared the Kremlin, because They cleared the opposition of every bright personality they could think of. And here's this guy who is this gray 60-year-old, you know, nothing of a candidate. You know, basically you can think of him as a laughingstock just to play the role. And the support that he garnered was unexpected, to say the least. So, you know, the times may create the man. I don't know.
We will leave it there, Sasha. Listen, I will chat to you. I'll chat to you off air. We'll have a little natter over the next couple of days. But again, as always, it's lovely to hear you. It's kind of heartbreaking in a way to hear you, because I know you've got family on both sides. You've got family involved and family divided. So we will chat to you very soon.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, David.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Well, John, I mean, there's Sasha. I think we should leave it there. We will come back to Russia, come back to Ukraine, of course, in the coming weeks. But what it kind of underscores is a regime that has no compulsion about killing anyone.
Yeah.
So imagine what it feels like to be Russian now. And you're in Russia. You know what's happening in your country. You also know that Putin is not afraid of killing. As I said to Sasha, this is like the white South Africans killing Mandela.
Yeah.
He was as big.
Yeah.
170 million people saw that video. He was a household name in Russia and snuffed out.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine how that feels if you're living in Russia now. It must be a very, very dark place. Very dark place.
But also, if you've seen any of the Russian TV or media coverage of it, it is very much a by story.
Oh, yeah. But it's, as Sasha said, you know, it's a by story officially, but it's the only story unofficially. We'll talk to you Thursday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.